From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer David Roberts is not entirely sure what it is about the remote canyons of the American Southwest that has captivated him for so many years. There's the beauty part, of course, the challenge of the terrain. And then there's the allure of what he calls a great cultural mystery of the people who abandoned the region more than 700 years ago. For more than 20 years, Roberts has gone back to the region time again to wander, to look at the art on the cliff faces, to explore the dwellings. His latest book is built around those journeys and the discoveries he's made. We're learning more and more about the people who made their lives among those cliffs, but Robert says the central puzzles remain unsolved. So his book is a way to bring them, what he calls the old ones, to life. David Roberts will join us today after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Roberts learned his lesson with his first book about the ancient ruins and rock art of the American Southwest. He had come to be enamored with the place, and after years of exploring the canyons and mesas of the Colorado Plateau, he wrote about his experiences in 1996. He interviewed archaeologists and other scholars trying to make sense of the Native Americans who had lived and then abandoned the place more than 700 years ago. And the book was successful, but it also created a backlash of people worried it would bring careless tourists to these fragile places. One ranger in the area, he reports, even suggested Roberts should just shut the bleep up. And he wonders from time to time if he should keep his mouth shut about these elusive places that often hold remarkable relics. But his new book is evidence he doesn't intend to keep his story to himself. The book chronicles his journeys and what he's learned from what he calls the Old Ones. The book is called The Lost World of the Old Ones, and David Roberts is joining us today to talk about it. We invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Roberts is a mountaineer, the writer of books on climbing and Western history. Among them are On the Ridge Between Life and Death and Devil's Gate, Brigham Young and the Great Mormon Handcart Tragedy. He's joining us today. I should mention, by the way, before that he's going to be giving readings here, and we'll tell you more about that as we go along. David Roberts, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Doug. It's great to be back on your show.
I want to begin with Cedar Mesa, because I guess this is the place where you kind of got hooked by the American Southwest in that terrain. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's really, I often say it's my favorite place in the whole world right now. And the reason is that it's probably the best place in the Southwest to see unrestored ruins and amazing rock art in very obscure places. And except for the best known sites, you can often venture there for days without seeing another person. Plus, the landscape is just stunning.
Yeah, that kind of goes without saying, the landscape. It's interesting, though, you write about another thing you've written about, of course, and we've talked to you about this, is climbing, mountaineering. And you describe in this new book that contrast, or maybe even the conflicting ideals between climbing and wandering and, you know, hiking in the desert Southwest. And this is sort of how you lay it out. You say climbing is an individual pursuit. It's also competitive, but hiking in the canyon country is not. It's not about an individual pursuit. It's different.
Yes, what I spent my first 20 years of adventuring in my 20s and 30s as a pretty serious mountaineer in Alaska, doing first ascents, going to ranges that had barely explored. And climbing was the most important thing in my life. And then it sort of dwindled, and I couldn't figure out what to do to replace it. And one day I wandered into Bullet Canyon on Cedar Mesa and was stunned to find, I didn't realize there were unrestored ruins. And there were corn cobs in the ground just as they'd been eaten and thrown away by the ancestral Pueblans 700 years ago. And that sparked something profound in me, and it gave me a revelation, which is that climbing is ultimately quite selfish and just about oneself. And that's why it's so competitive, because the only reward is to do something that everybody else said was too hard to do. And so you get bragging rights. But this exploration of the backcountry looking for vestiges of the ancient ones isn't just about yourself. It's about them. It's about trying to figure out what they were doing and who they were and why. And so it takes the edge off of that egomaniacal pursuit for its own sake and turns it into a quest for understanding of someone else. Hmm.
So pretty much every spring and fall, you go back to the Colorado Plateau. Explain what you're looking for. Maybe that's not the way to put it. I assume you're not exactly looking for something, but you certainly go for a purpose.
I am looking for something. I'm looking for something I haven't seen before. I'm looking for ways to get to the... you mentioned climbing. One thing that attracts me to the ancestral Pueblans and the Fremont and the other categories of prehistoric people in the Southwest is that they were pretty darn good climbers themselves. They were genius climbers. And you find granaries and even ruins 100 feet up vertical cliffs with no apparent way to get to them. So, and by and large, archaeologists have ignored this aspect of the cultural phenomenon. It's obviously defensive. They're hiding their grain from the bad guys who might steal it. But it's so extreme that you wonder if there isn't some spiritual or aesthetic impulse also going on here. And to get to those sites is a challenge in its own right.
Wait, what do you mean by that? Something more than just the practicality of hiding their corn. There was something else there? What do you mean? That's interesting.
Well, it isn't just granaries. You'll find rock art in places that are really hard to climb to get to. Why do you need to put rock art in a scary, at the top of a scary climb, unless you're making some kind of pronouncement? I mean, we'll never know what the rock art means.
Sure.
I quote Steve Lexon, my favorite archaeologist, as saying, the whole body of rock art amounts to an amazing set of data, but we'll never decode it.
Yeah.
But it's nonetheless tantalizing for that.
I mentioned the first book about this region that you published in 1996, In Search of the Old Ones is the title. And in it you tell this story of one particular journey. This was a four-day backpack in 1993. And you came upon this large, intact ceramic pot. Would you tell that story? Just what was that like to see that, to find that?
I mean, back then, I could go 4 days on a backpack in late October, early November, and not see another person, and go down a canyon, one of the minor canyons on Cedar Mesa, and make discoveries that were completely new to me and that were not published anywhere. And on the third day, I got to this very difficult ruin to get to that I'd seen from across the canyon. Couldn't see it from anywhere else. Couldn't see it from the canyon bottom. And when I got up there, it was a great ruin. I was happy. It was a really cold, windy day. And I decided just to walk up the ledge below it to the right and see if there was anything else there. And I was walking along the ledge. It got thinner and thinner. Finally, it dead-ended out in vertical cliff. And just as I was turning to head back, I looked down to my left and I saw this gorgeous, large, totally intact corrugated pot tucked in a little niche. And I wondered if I'd been the first person to see it since the whatever potter had left it there maybe in, let's guess, 1260 AD. And, I mean, there are very few experiences in life so thrilling. I mean, it's stunning. You know, all the cliches apply.
Yeah.
the chill going down my spine, my hair standing on end. So I spent at least an hour there just marveling at the pod and looking at it. I touched it, but I didn't even try to move it.
Yeah.
And then I wrote about it. Right. I opened the In Search of the Old Ones with my description of that discovery. What I didn't anticipate was that people who read the book would treat it like a treasure map,
yeah.
and they would start going to try to find that very pot, even though I hadn't even named the canyon it was in. I thought it was vague enough about where I was that nobody would ever find it from my book, but some people did some real Sherlock Holmes-type detective work and discovered it, and that created... That's part of the backlash you mentioned.
Yeah.
A lot of people got really angry, including the rangers at Cane Gulch, got pretty angry with me for creating a treasure map, even though that had never been the slightest intention of mine. I should have known better.
Well, you learned your lesson, as you mentioned, and we'll get to another remarkable story a little bit later in the program. But I guess you have to just be. You mentioned virtually nothing about where someone might be able to find this particular relic.
Right.
I guess that's a lesson you learn. I wanted to ask you about Range Creek because this is how you begin this new book. For those who are unaware, I mean, I think a lot of people around here anyway know what Range Creek is, but let's start. Explain the significance of Range Creek.
Range Creek was the private domain of a rancher named Waldo Wilcox for 50 years. And during those 50 years, he kept all trespassers out. He had pretty stiff fences on either end. It's a very remote canyon on the Tavaputs Plateau, just west of the Green River and Desolation Canyon. And his 12-mile-long piece of the valley basically had no trespassers for five decades. And what was so remarkable about Waldo, who's one of the heroes of my new book, mm-hmm. is that out of pure instinct, he found what he called Indian stuff all over the place, and he left everything intact. You know, most old-timers collect all the arrowheads and the metates and the pots and put them on their mantle or make little displays in their front yard. But Waldo had the sense that he had no right to mess with the Indian stuff, so that when he, in his old age, in his 70s, finally succumbed to the fact that he couldn't herd 300 head of cattle anymore, he sold the spread to the state of Utah. And when the archaeologists took the first look at it, they said, they were just flabbergasted. They said, this is the best preserved, pristine piece of archaeological history anywhere in the West. That was in 2002. Mm-hmm. And we've only begun to plumb the richness of the cultural heritage in that creek.
You tell a number of stories on Range Creek. One of them is a story you tell of this speck that Waldo Wilcox spots back in 1951. Turns out to be a pretty remarkable story in of itself. Tell that story, if you would, that speck that Waldo sees.
I think it was in 1951. Waldo was standing in the bottom of the canyon. He looked way up, 1,000 feet up, and he said, there's something up there. And his brother and his father, who were still part of the ranch at that time, said, nah, it's just a natural ledge or something. And Waldo said, nah, there's something there, something Indian there. And actually took him several years. He went to Japan during the war. No, he went to Korea during the war and used field glasses for the first time and bought a cheap Japanese pair and brought them back and checked out that speck on the cliff, and sure enough, it was man-made. So in 54 or thereabouts, Waldo made this arduous bushwhack hike, scramble up to the cliff, and what he saw there blew his mind, and blew our minds almost 50 years, more than 50 years later.
I'm going to have you read a section, because you went and explored that spec with the climber Greg Child and a woman named Renee Barlow. She was, at that time anyway, on this team from the Utah Museum of Natural History. Set this up for us. It was a May morning. You were with Greg Child, and he says, my mind is blown too.
Yeah. because we were with Renee Barlow, who was one of the official archaeology team, we were allowed to hike up and even try to get into these sites. What Waldo came back saying is that he had seen a big old granary on a ledge above an overhanging cliff. So I'll read this passage from my book. This is about Greg, me, and Renee returning there in, I think, 2005. As Waldo had reported, a 25-foot-long trunk of dead Douglas fir leaned against the cliff directly below the granary. It was apparently a Fremont ladder, still in place at least 650 years after it had been placed there. Breaching an otherwise featureless cliff inclined only a shade less than vertical, the trunk looked far too spindly to climb. Even more daunting, the, quote, big old granary, unquote, actually a pair of granaries sharing a common wall, hovered a good 40 feet above the tip of the fir tree, and those 40 feet were relentlessly overhanging. And above the double granary, the cliff soared for another 90 feet at an even steeper overhanging angle. The lip of the cliff, 150 feet up, loomed dizzyingly in space as we craned our necks to study the Fremont wonder. Above the tip of the Douglas fir, a thin crack split a pair of arching overhangs. That crack had evidently been the ascent line of the daredevil who had pioneered the route, for halfway between the treetop and the granary, a hefty stick had been jammed endwise into the fissure, like a huge wooden piton. The stick might have been the key to reaching the hand and footholds on the cliff above.
Now, the question that came to me when you think about the effort that it took to get there, because you write about the Greg Childs, who's a world-class climber, having to put in cams and ropes. I mean, something, technology that you point out, the Fremont did not have access to. So how do you figure they did it? What's the, because you and Greg had this sort of ongoing dispute you write about where he figured they had to have had ropes, but you don't really find ropes lying around down there. What's your theory on how it is that they climbed to such heights to build these granaries and things?
Greg and I have been sleuthing the backcountry for 10 years now, and we have many ongoing debates, and I defer to him as the finer climber by far, as you say, a world-class climber. But I initially thought, well, they didn't have ropes, they didn't have spring-loaded cams, they didn't rappel the way we did to get to the ruin. So how did they get there? So I initially thought some daredevil, as I called him, climbed what climbers would probably call a 5'11 crack to get to the ledge. And Greg said, no way. Greg said, that wooden stick is not a piton, it's not a handhold, it's part of a scaffolding or a weird kind of zigzag ladder system that allowed them to get up there. And the rest of which has simply fallen off and deteriorated and vanished during the last 700 years. I think Greg's explanation is probably the better one because, as he pointed out, even if the daredevil climbed up there, how does he get the mud and stones up there to build that double granary? How do they get the corn and beans and squash up there to fill this gigantic storage bin? And how do they retrieve it regularly? And why did they, but for both of us, why such a, you can put a granary 20 feet up, a hard climb, and it's pretty safe. Why do you put it in a place that's almost impossible for modern climbers to get to? That's the abiding mystery of.
Yeah.
And the granary in Range Creek is only one of hundreds that we've seen like that. That, by the way, the Fremont people are the northern neighbors of the ancestral Puebloans, and they basically occupy all of Utah north of the Colorado River. And they turn out to be every bit as good climbers as the ancestral Puebloans were, what we used to call the Anasazi.
It's interesting that you mentioned that there was they did this test. The end of the question was, did they have ropes? Did they use ropes to do this work? And you mentioned this test that people conducted with these yucca fibers. They even sent it to REI in Washington State to see just how strong a rope like this would be. Say something about that.
I initially thought that the Anasazi, to use the word I used to use, didn't have ropes because you don't find rope. You find string. You find nets to catch rabbits. You find twine of all kinds made out of yucca and others, willow and even human hair. But you don't find big, thick ropes that of the kind that it would take to haul heavy rocks up to build a granary. But, you know, Greg also pointed out there were rope grooves on that cliff. You don't get grooves without ropes.
Yeah.
And so some years ago, I hired a New Mexico archaeologist who was really good at doing this sort of thing to try to make some short hunks of rope out of yucca. It's an incredibly tedious process. And he did so, and we tested them. And they're about as good as a cheap clothesline. I can't imagine trusting my life to one. The breaking strength is enough so that you took a short fall, you'd snap it in half. But they probably did make extraordinary pieces of cordage and even ropes out of yucca.
What did Waldo Wilcox, what were his theories? He's such an interesting figure because his experience with, I mean, he's not an archaeologist, he's not a scientist, he isn't a highly educated man, even though you describe him as this walking encyclopedia of knowledge, and obviously no one knew that area more intimately than Waldo Wilcox, and he had the foresight really to not touch any of those sites for the most part. What were his theories? What were his ideas about that people? Did he, because he seemed to have kind of an instinctual sense of those people.
Waldo knew he couldn't climb up to that granary, but he was a pretty good climber in cowboy boots and using his lariat for a rope.
Yeah.
He had a standard trick. If he had to lower himself off a cliff, he would just loop the lariat around a tree, tie one end to himself, lower himself down, then pull the rope after him. And he would even do that with his hunting dogs. But over the years, he formed a theory that the first people in Range Creek are what he called the little people, and they were barely 5 feet tall. And the Fremont came in and wiped them out, and then years later the Ute came in and wiped out the Fremont. And Waldo even thought he had found a place, a butte top he called the Fortress, that was mm-hmm. covered with arrowheads, which he decided was the site of the Fremont last stand. Well, professional archaeologists would say this is all nonsense. Yeah. And in fact, during the time we were there, there was a very edgy confrontation between the chief archaeologist, who essentially dismissed Waldo's theories, and Waldo sensed that these highfalutin, you know, PhD types didn't know any more than he did. He loved to say, "I figure I knew Range Creek better than anyone ever did, because them Indians didn't live very long."
Right. Well, the tension you write about between Waldo Wilcox and the archaeologists who had come to explore Range Creek. We'll get to that when we get back from a break. David Roberts is with us. His book is called The Lost World of the Old Ones, Discoveries in the Ancient Southwest. Tomorrow night at 7, David Roberts is going to be giving a reading at the Weller Book Works at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Saturday night at 7, he's going to be at the back of Beyond Books in Moab. For information on these events, you can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer and mountaineer David Roberts is back with us. His latest book is another exploration of the prehistoric people of the American Southwest, the Native Americans who flourished in the region and then mysteriously abandoned the place more than 700 years ago. Roberts has a kind of obsession for the story, and he spent the last 20 years or so exploring the remote canyons, even climbing those sheer sandstone cliffs to see what's left of the dwellings there and what they may say about the lives and the culture of the people who lived there. The book is stories about his journey and what he's learned. It's called The Lost World of the Old Ones. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. One of the things you write about, David Roberts, is you were just saying this before the break, the kind of antipathy, the kind of disdain that Waldo Wilcox had with the archaeologist who would come to explore on the property he sells. And there's the story you tell, the so-called corn grinder story. He didn't think much of... I'm not sure if he's always felt this way, but you tell the story about the fact that... I don't know what it is. How do you describe, I guess, or explain maybe the antipathy he felt for the archaeologists who would come to work on his property? Because he shared similar kinds of respect for the land and the people, but there was some tension there.
Well, there was tension from the very first moment because the practice of the Utah team of archaeologists was to gather up everything. And they did it in professional style. They would GPS every single potsherd they picked up, put little flags there while they took the GPS. But then they took the chert flakes, the arrowheads, the corn grinders or metates, mm-hmm. To gather up to ultimately curate in Salt Lake City. And Waldo saw the stuff that he had left for 50 years being just systematically picked up and put in plastic bags. So that really upset him. He kept saying, I think this valley is the best darn museum the place could have. This is where the stuff should stay. But he also, I'll tell you the corn grinder story very briefly. There were a couple of grad students in the team who were more ambitious than the others and willing to hike long distances. So Waldo told him about an arch way up high where there was some neat stuff. So he sent the two grad students up there. And years before, Waldo had found the skull of a Fremont burial coming out of the ground. And with an instinct for reverence, he picked up a nearby metate, which is the grinding basin for corn and other grains, and inverted it and put it over the skull to hide it and to save it from the elements. Just an instinct of reverence. And so the grad students exhausted themselves getting up there, came back and glowing with a sense of discovery and said, we've discovered something nobody knew about the Fremont. They buried their dead with metates on their heads. Waldo sort of chuckled and said, yep, and I'll bet I can tell you right where that was.
You're somewhat critical of the Utah Museum of Natural History crew. You write about a personal conflict that you believe affected the study of the Range Creek area between Duncan Metcalf and Renee Barlow, who you mentioned earlier, who are now divorced. Renee, you report, had her access to that site limited. You also seem surprised and critical of the fact that very little of the research in Range Creek has really been published, that they're kind of preoccupied, you say, with kind of the minutiae. I mean, you're looking for a big picture analysis, and you're not seeing it yet. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I don't want to single out particular people, but And I'm not a good judge of professional archaeology as it's done in the field. I'm an adequate, fair judge, but not an expert. But it felt to me that there was something sort of old-fashioned about all this gathering and storing in drawers back in Salt Lake City. And, you know, it's been 13 years now since they started work, and there is nothing like a comprehensive paper or monograph written about it. But, of course, it can take more than 13 years to do that. And I did hear that something may be coming out this year.
Yeah.
But by and large, the few papers that have been published are obsessed with minutiae, with very small questions, which is the trend of archaeology today anyway. But I wasn't impressed.
We did reach out to the museum to get a response, and they didn't directly respond to any of the particular things that you mentioned necessarily. They did point out that there have been, in a statement, they said nearly 24 papers and posters that have been presented, a half a dozen articles and reports have been written, and they did mention, as you said just a moment ago, a major monograph summarizing the last decade of research is coming out next year.
Yeah. And several of the grad students have done some really good publications. Shannon Boomgarden in particular. The partial tragedy was that Renee Barlow and Duncan Metcalf were the co-leaders of the team, and they went through a very unpleasant divorce, which created a schism between Renee's research and the rest of the team's. They haven't even read each other's field notes. And that, of course, wreaks havoc with a comprehensive project. That's just really too bad.
The thing that seems to bother you the most, though, is, as you said, that even though they were careful about it, they were very careful, in fact, about it, but the removal of the relics and the artifacts was something that really shocked you, disturbed you. I mean, you like the idea, as a colleague of yours had said, of Range Creek and other places being outdoor museums as opposed to confining them into inside places.
The outdoor museum is the coinage of my friend Fred Blackburn, who's based in Cortez, Colorado. And his idea, after years of being a BLM ranger, was that the best thing to do is to leave everything in place, because that way it not only preserves the provenience of the object, but it allows someone else to have, the next person who comes across it, to have the same thrill of discovery as you did. Some archaeologists see this as not only romantic, but possibly elitist, in the sense that if I find something really cool and I tell a couple of friends and they tell a couple of friends, we're sort of making a private club as opposed to turning the evidence over for possible understanding by a much wider audience. I mean, there have been great monographs written about Southwestern archaeology that hugely advance our understanding, but there are also cases of guys who have worked for 40 years at a site and never published a word, and that is just desecration. Mm-hmm. There's no getting around it.
You tell the story about Renee Barlow finding on one of these excursions of yours this obsidian arrowhead, and she confessed that she had taken it from the site. Really bothered you, but then on the other hand, she goes out and she sources where the obsidian came from, and she found something out about the people who would have made that arrowhead. So there's the conflict, I guess. On one hand, leave it there and wonder about the people. On the other hand, pick it up, take it, source it, do some science, and find something.
Yeah, I have to give Renee credit for finding the source, which is quite a long ways to the west of Range Creek. Obsidian is a very, very special kind of stone. It's the sharpest, makes the sharpest arrowheads and knives you can construct, and it's rare, very rare in Range Creek. And the thing is, Greg and I got her into this site with ropes, and she didn't tell me that she had picked up the arrowhead, which I'd found, and stuck it in her pocket or in her bag until later. And I was initially dismayed, but then when she came back with the sourcing information, I had to give her credit. It was a good, really good piece of science.
Yeah.
And it really did tell us something about the, the Fremont and Range Creek.
Let me ask you about one more story from Range Creek before we move on. You and Greg Childs came across an ancient maze carved on a rock. And I wanted you to talk about that because you write in the book that it gave you this sense of lost meaning that you say ached inside of you, and that you connected that to what you saw as Waldo's regret. Waldo Wilcox, again, being regretful of the fact that the archaeologists were removing these relics from that land.
Yeah. Greg and I, on another excursion, got to a really remote place, and we scrambled up the side of the hill halfway out of the canyon, and Greg found this boulder, the whole top of which was covered with an abstract petroglyph design that looked very, very old. Waldo had never seen it, and in fact, one thing admirable about Waldo is he actually said, I figure, in all those 50 years, I haven't even seen one-tenth of what the Indians left behind. And Waldo had never seen that maze. And, you know, we have no idea what it meant. The Hopi might say it was a migration map from the place of emergence from the Third World. But how do you prove or disprove that? But Waldo knew so much that nobody else knew that he's now in his early 80s, and I'm hoping to see him next week in Green River. I have this sense, this really sad sense, that when he dies, a huge part of the meaning of Range Creek is going to die with him.
David Roberts is with us. His new book is called The Lost World of the Old Ones. He's joining us today from Nevada Public Radio in Las Vegas. He's coming to Utah tomorrow night at 7. He's going to be giving a reading at the Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Saturday night, he'll be in Moab at the back of Beyond Books there. For information about all of that, you can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a quick break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer and mountaineer David Roberts. We're talking about his new book, The Lost World of the Old Ones, Discoveries in the Ancient Southwest is the subtitle there. He's going to be in Utah tomorrow at the Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square reading from the book. He's going to be in Moab at Back of Beyond Books there on Saturday. We'll give you those details a little bit later in the program, too. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Let's take a few calls. Tim is with us in Layton, Utah. Tim, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to talk to David about some really sad things that I found in canyonlands in the Salt Creek, where there's been a lot of traffic and people taking manatees, matados, and dropping them off from the sites down to try and take them, and then they'd be broken at the bottom, and such a sad thing. I've spent many days hiking for like a week in the area and found some beautiful granaries and things with no trail or anything into them. And we were very careful not to produce trailing and things. And we found over in cattle areas where people have burnt out the areas out of the wood ceilings and things like that. But so I don't know what I'm trying to say other than it's too bad that some people can't recognize how beautiful and wonderful those places are and destroy them.
David Roberts, this is something that obviously concerns you. I mean, this is part of the lesson you learned from that first book you wrote. What do you make of that? I mean, on one hand, because it seems like there's such an impulse to when you see something, I mean, you see a matate. Or as you've seen, pottery and this remarkable story we'll come to later about a basket. I mean, I guess there is that. You want to bring it home. You want to do something with it. I mean, what do you make of that story that you hear from Tim and others?
Well, thanks to the caller for bearing witness to his own sadness about the destruction and removal of artifacts. It's you've got all kinds of looting. You have systematic looting by criminals who go in there with shovels and even backhoes and dig way down in the ground, toss away the bones, and grab everything they can. And there was the Blanding bust a few years ago, which is another whole story. But then you just have sort of casual pilfering. I mean, I kept the first arrowheads I ever found, and I have no idea what shoebox they're in today. But you quickly learn that you have no right to take anything. It's against the law, among other things. Mm-hmm. But even just casual visitation can wreck a place. It's a gorgeous ruin on Cedar Mesa called Moon House that has a very delicate opening made out of adobe. And you watch hikers who are respectful and well-meaning but just clueless about how to treat a site, just grabbing on the doorway and yanking on it. And we've all seen walls destroyed, and I've even seen dogs crawling through ruins, which is really off limits. And I write a kind of Return to Cedar Mesa chapter in which I talk about how sites that I once saw that were covered with artifacts have been almost denuded of them. Everything's gone. And it's just people picking up a few and sticking them in their pockets and taking them home and thinking, oh, they won't miss five pot shards, and they always take the prettiest ones. But I've been terrified for years that somebody would take that pot out of the canyon that I found in 93, I think.
Yeah.
Or the basket, which is still there, thank God. It's the most remarkable thing I've ever found anywhere.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Tim, thanks very much. Back to the phones. Randall is with us in Salt Lake. Randall, hi.
Hi, how are you? Just giving you a brief story about it. I'm a commercial river guide, at least I was when I was younger. And we worked on the Upper Salt River. This spot was on the White Mountain Apache Reservation. And we camped across from a ruin, which was quite an arduous hike to get to. One of the gentlemen on the trip got up basically at dark, took one of our boats, ferried across the river, climbed up there, dug into the burial site, and got a sheath for a knife that was ancient.
Wow.
Didn't tell anybody but his girlfriend. Luckily, they broke up on the trip, and she felt bad about it. She knew about the sheath and told me 3 days later. I confronted him. He refused to give it back to me. He said he was part Indian, blah, de, blah. Well, I said, get ready, something bad's going to happen. Well, not a minute later, he put his hand in his pocket of his coat and was stung by a scorpion. And he couldn't breathe. He had anaphylactic shock, and we rushed him out.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Talk about instant karma. Hope I'm not on the radio.
Randall, glad
I wish
you called.
That would happen. We could wish that on every artifact stealer. That's an incredible story.
Well, thanks.
We, commercial guides, we have to look after everything.
Yeah, I bet.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Well, sorry about that. You write about your own, speaking of river guides, your own trip down Desolation Canyon. And this is interesting. I mean, speaking of the kind of curse idea, you say during that trip, you yourself entertained this idea that there may have been something about Desolation Canyon that could have been, you know, bad juju for the Fremont. What did you mean by that?
Well, I took a commercial trip down Desolation Canyon on the Green 2 years ago, and specifically not to ride the rapids, which is what most people do, but to spend as much time as possible in the side canyons, because it's all Fremont and it's very little studied. And what we found was lots and lots of rock art, some very minimalist granaries, and one or two or three or even no habitation sites. So what's the puzzle here? Jerry Spangler is of the Colorado Plateau Archaeological Association is the best expert on that. But what's going on there? Why do you have all these storage sites? Why do you bother to paint magnificent panels of rock art and you don't live there? And my thought, and it's just a hunch, it's not again, testable, is that this was the canyon had something about it that was bad juju. It was a scary place. It's a scary place because it's hard to cross the river, for one thing. Lots of people have drowned crossing the river. But Zion, for instance, was very little visited by ancestral Puebloans or even by the Utes. And we think of Zion as this magnificent cathedral-like place, but maybe it was bad juju for the ancients. We'll never know. But landscapes certainly do have... it's interesting that Powell, who was the first to take a raft down the desolation, their men found it really spooky. That's why they called it Desolation Canyon. To us, it was beautiful, yeah. I think, to most river runners. But it freaked Powell out and his men, too.
I want to have you talk about the story. As you referred to this basket that you found, the most astounding thing that you had ever encountered. This was in 1994. I want to have you read a section from the book when you first find this. I'm not sure if we need to say anything to set this up, but you mentioned that you kind of walked past it. Really, we need to give the credit to your wife. She's the one that found it.
Yeah, I was with my wife, Sharon, in 94 in a very remote canyon and just sort of checking every alcove. And I walked the back edge, the back wall of this alcove that wasn't very promising looking, and found maybe three little red chert flakes. And I thought, well, there's nothing here. And I walked past, and I was just ahead of Sharon. I walked right past this thing, and I'll read the paragraph in which I describe her discovery of it. Sharon chanced to look down and to her left. It was then that she uttered her cry of astonishment. I turned to see her bent over, hands on knees, staring into the dim recess formed by a pair of slabs that leaned against each other, forming a tent-like nook. I got down on my knees and crawled close to the accidental cavity. There, beneath the leaning stones, lying face down, was a perfectly intact basket made of either yucca or willow fiber. The weaving was so exquisite and tight that the basket almost certainly would have held water. I knew from similar objects I had seen in museums that this one must date from the Basket Maker II era, so at a minimum, it was 1,500 years old. It's an exquisite object in a truly obscure place, and we went back 2 years ago to see if it was still there, and thank God it still is. But I'm terrified that either a pot hunter or even the BLM itself will find it and take it.
You write about how in 94 you discover it, you go back, as you say, 2 years ago, and all in the time in between there was this nagging fear, is it still there? And I guess that hasn't left you. You still worry about that.
Of course. I mean, you'll never know. You know, I'll go to my deathbed not knowing whether it's still there.
Yeah. You say that that taking the basket out of its hiding place would have been profane. You say that the point is not to own something, but as you sort of referred to earlier, leave it to others to have that same kind of thrill. But I wanted to point this out. Eventually, that basket is going to disintegrate, as you point out in the book itself, and that no one is going to be able to study it or discern the lives of the person who crafted it. It's just going to vanish kind of into thin air. Do you feel at all conflicted about that?
Not really, because this basket has been there 1,500 years, and it looks like it's new. I mean, it's climate controlled,
yeah,
by the natural climate of the Southwest, which preserves everything beautifully if it's under an overhang. The museums are full of baskets from which we've learned very little, and the backcountry is not full of baskets anymore. I don't feel conflicted because if the basket we found is that intact, that perfect after 1,500 years, it's going to be another 1,500 or even 3,000 before it falls to pieces. So I can't worry about folks finding it 3,000 years from now if the human race still exists.
You write in the book that question you ask yourselves these days: how many more seasons do you have to go wandering and explore those places? There's an email from Pat, who's read your book, and she writes about, as she puts it, that sadness at the end of your book where you face the prospect of your own mortality. And Pat says, how can we still enjoy exploration while balancing a respect for the history of the old ones and our own bodies? What do you make of that question?
Well, I'm 71, and I've gone out to the Southwest every spring and fall for 23 years, and sometimes summer and winter. It's usually the high point, one of the high points of my year, and I speculate at the end, you know, how many more years can I do this? I mean, there are plenty of people my age who can hardly hike. I do end on a sad note, I think, but more wistful than sorrowful, because that prowling and exploring has given me some of the greatest happiness of my life.
David Roberts, his book is The Lost World of the Old Ones. Tomorrow night at 7, he's giving a reading at Weller Bookworks in Salt Lake City. Then on Saturday night, he'll be in Moab at Back of Beyond Books there, also speaking at 7 o'clock. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. David Roberts, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Braden Child. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.